Visible is a wireless carrier that is not invisible. It is pretty clear from the name. Actually, radio waves are invisible. And I can say this with authority as a licensed amateur radio operator. That being said, Visible won't be giving you the power to see light outside the visible spectrum. It's actually way better because having that ability would make getting around very difficult and distracting. What you do get with Visible is unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. You get one line of wireless, just $25 a month, which is great in these times of economic uncertainty. That is one line for $25, taxes and fees included. So whatever you're doing at this moment, please stop. Switch immediately. Now, monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Wir gerne sehen, was ist los? It's deinen Freund, Seth. I'm learning German. Yeah, in case you didn't know what that was. That is me trying to impress you with the little German that I know. Right now, I am actually learning German. I took it in high school. I goofed off the entire time. I did some other language learning apps. They taught me things like where the taxi stand is and how to find a bus, but not a lot of conversational German. Thankfully, that's what Babbel is all about. Babbel teaches you language conversationally, which, let's face it, that is what you want to know anyway. I don't know. When I was in school, you learned like how to count. You learned like the colors. You learned the shapes. Those are all important things, but they don't help you when you're in like Cologne, Germany with Ein Nierenstein, which, by the way, is German for kidney stone, an experience I can unfortunately speak personally to. But I've been using Babbel to learn to speak German again, better than I have before. I actually really like it because it is conversational. It's a little bit more relaxed. One of the things that it does that I really like is it'll sometimes show you what the literal English translation is. And I don't know why, but I find that very helpful in sort of understanding the structure, the grammar of a language and sort of putting myself into that mind space. Since I'm only in Germany for Gamescom, which is like a week, week and a half, I'm not immersed in the German language. I'm not immersed in German culture. So what I do is the second best thing. I'm taking Babbel. Hopefully this year when I go to Germany, I'll be able to impress all the Germans with how much German I know from learning through Babbel. The app has pronunciation recognition, so you'll be able to learn how to speak better with your accent, how to actually properly pronounce the words. That way you won't get made fun of by a group of older German men because you said apple strudel and not Apfelstrudel. No, it's really cool. I'm going to say right now there is a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now you can get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, because you guys are the best ones, by the way, at babbel.com/realm. Get 60% off at babbel.com/realm. That is spelled babbel.com/realm. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Listen.
Hello and welcome to NVC, IGN's Nintendo podcast. This week we will be talking about how F-Zero is actually not dead. And more nuggets from IGN's interview with an ex-designer who is with Nintendo for 30 years. Also, we'll be talking about how you'll be able to print your Pokemon Snap photos and the great Ace Attorney coming to the U.S. and a whole lot more. I'm your host, Casey DeFritas, and this week I'm joined by Per Schneider.
Welcome.
Brian Altano.
Welcome.
And Logan Plant.
Welcome.
As triple a reminder, welcome. Our awesome production assistant. So,
what's up?
Yeah. Hey. So everyone, thank you so much for being here to talk about this today, because, you know, I'm going to be honest. I have never played an F-Zero game.
Ooh,
I know. Crazy. Unless you count the minigame in Nintendo Land and the associations with Smash, I've never played one. I don't know.
So you don't know frustration and anger. Oh, wait, no, you play Monster.
Yeah, I was like, I don't know about that. I know a little bit, but you can see some of F-Zero on the screen right here, but I'm gonna let you guys take this conversation away. Basically, the ex-Nintendo designer Takuya Imamura, he's a retired Nintendo artist who designed helped design stuff like The Legend of Zelda Majora's Mask. He's responsible for Tingle. He worked on F-Zero, was one of his first games that he worked on, and he talked in pretty in-depth with an interview we had with him. He just left Nintendo in January, was there for 30 years, worked directly with Miyamoto, has a ton of experience. I do implore everyone to go read that full article. It's incredibly interesting. But Per and Logan here are huge F-Zero fans. So the direct quote is, "The series is hard to bring back without a grand idea." So take it away, F-Zero fans.
I don't know how many of the games you've played, Logan, but, you know, I've been on board since the Super NES, played it on N64, played it on 64DD, on Game Boy Advance, and, you know, saw its swan song on GameCube and really liked that game too, you know. But it's definitely a series that has not evolved a lot when you think about the concept of it, right? Like it's a cyber racer starring Captain Falcon and others, that is all centered around precision racing at really high speeds and that kind of shield and boost management system. And over the years, they've changed things. Like they went from Mode 7 to 3D surfaces where you're racing on the outside of pipes and in half pipes, and it was really, really cool. But it's always stayed very similar. They're light attacks, like spinning to attack an enemy in the later games, but like it's always been centered around like pure drift racing at super high speeds. And you know, when I mentioned frustration, the big thing about F-Zero is you leave the course, you're dead. There's no beep putting you back on the track or anything.
There's no lack of two.
Everything is rainbow road.
Yeah. And so I, you know, I can see Imamura's argument that, you know, F-Zero GX, which is just freaking awesome. It's such a great game, right? From the creator of Daytona USA, who's over at Sega now working on the Yakuza games. He was the lead on this Sega and Nintendo co-production in the arcades and on the GameCube. And it's a fantastic game, but it is so hard that there's no matter how skilled you are, you will be very angry at this game. And I bet if they pulled data on it, 99% of the people who played it did not unlock the significant extra tracks that are in the game from the arcade.
No, they didn't get past the third race pair. They didn't get past a lot of people that I know personally, not myself, of course, because I'm an expert gamer, never got past the third race in this game, despite trying for years. And so that's, you know, obviously there needs to be something to account for that. It's an interesting franchise, right? Because it's like this was a launch game for the Super Nintendo. It was one of the most like incredible experiences ever to play that on day one. And then we got the GameCube version, obviously, which was like really, really cool down the line. Gorgeous. And like what it was doing here was like so impressive. It still looks good for sure.
Yeah.
Sega tag teaming on this game. And then we got a bunch of GBA ones that I think kind of just fell through the cracks and got forgotten. But to me, it's like this is sort of synonymous with the fact that like the futuristic racing genre in general has definitely died down a lot over the last few years. That's something that, you know, Wipeout was doing. You know, obviously F-Zero was doing. There was also like Extreme G? Yeah, they were there for like, you know, for Nintendo launches for a while. At the beginning of the Nintendo Switch launch, we got Fast RMX from, I believe, Shinen, which is like the closest we've come to a sort of like third party F-Zero game in a minute. But I don't necessarily know why Nintendo feels like the need to overthink this franchise. I don't really think that it needs a significant new hook, you know?
Yeah, I think I agree. You said it, though.
And also consider, I mean, Mario Kart is now the best selling is the best selling game on the Switch. So I mean, people, I know it's Mario Kart, but I mean, it's still a racing game, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it reminds me of different,
but
it reminds me of Star Fox, because that's a series that Nintendo, I feel like, has felt the need to reinvent over and over. You used to have the one on DS where you draw the paths, the Wii U one where you have the controls and the cockpit on the gamepad and the boots on the ground stuff and some of the other ones. And it's like, I don't think that series needs it either, because you talk about what you actually want from that series. You want it to go back to the best entry, like Star Fox 64, like F-Zero GX. And I think that the series has been gone long enough that it doesn't need a major reinvention. The F-Zero has been dormant longer than it was ever alive. The first one came out in 1990 and then the last one in 2004. And so it's been 17 years since the last one, longer than the history of the franchise. And
I totally agree.
Maybe the grand idea would be F-Zero on the Switch.
in a key with online multiplayer.
So I agree with it partially, because I do think there's a huge difference between the Switch and the Wii U. And like, remember on Wii U, we got Nintendo Land featuring arguably the worst attraction was the F-Zero themed one. So they didn't really do this justice. But Captain Falcon is popular in Smash, right? And so the F-Zero franchise is not an unknown. The Switch has the benefit of just being a hit, right? So you bring back Pikmin on Switch and it outsells the original release, and Mario Kart, you bring it back and it outsells the original. And so ergo, if you bring back F-Zero, I gotta think it'll do better than the original release, and they could double dip on F-Zero GX. But I think one issue with Nintendo is sometimes that better is the enemy of the good, and Nintendo looks at, you know, they probably look at the last 10 years of NPD sales and they say, rightfully, there's one racer on it. And that was back in 2001, I think, Need for Speed showed up. Ever since then, the top 10, even the top 20, didn't have a single racing game in it. No Forza, nothing, except for Mario Kart. And so if they were to say, hey, if we're going to make a new installment of F-Zero, we want to reinvent it, I do think it's time to add weapons. It doesn't mean that you have to take away from the like purist racing for the main mode, but like do a battle mode that feels like the Speed Racer movie or like the City Trial mode from Kirby Air, right? Like something like that, I think, to bring in people who love Mario Kart. Mm-hmm. But I don't understand why they wouldn't test the water by doing a quick remaster of F-Zero GX, because visually it is so stunning. They can tweak they can add an easy mode to it or something, because even story mode is so hard. I actually wrote the strategy guide for it for IGN, and
I wanted to hear about this.
it was so frustrating. Like some of the last story mode missions in GX were just so brutal. But, you know, speaking of innovation, like the racing in GX was similar to the racing in F-Zero X, but it did add the story mode that actually had cutscenes and like really played to the silly universe. So if they were going to redo it, like I think, honestly, it's one of those franchises that Nintendo has kicked the can to other studios, and there was no internal champion to say we should really spend our time on this instead of another project, right? Because they're finite resources. And so they sent it to, you know, Sega on the consoles. ND Cube did the first GBA one, Maximum Velocity, and then they kicked it to Suzak. There was actually an F-Zero game that never came out in the US from called F-Zero Climax, and you know, we only got GP Legend. So I feel like it's one of those franchises where they sent it to another team, had them do it, and they kind of like, maybe they just kind of lost the spark and the interest in it. Mm-hmm. But man, can't they get back together with...
I feel like you nailed really it back cool. there.
If yeah. you're watching it on YouTube, I mean, so like the good. Way it
yeah.
looks... I want to play this.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the track design in this game is brilliant. I mean, I got to play a bunch of it through the time trials because I didn't ever get past the third level in the main story because of the stupid boulders that kept falling out of my car. But I think you nailed it, Per. I think like a sort of like a Force Awakenings of this game, you know, modernize it. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. You can add a couple of bells and whistles. I think like making it accessible to all ages is important. Maybe adding some sort of multiplayer mode, like kind of like, you know, flesh out the package a little bit. To make it a justifiable thing. But we're in an era where Nintendo is doing so exceptionally well, and it feels like everything they put on Switch that they put a little bit of like first party polish behind sells well. And you know, we've said this for years on the show, but like this is the part where you start bringing in the F-Zeros and the Punch-Outs and your Metroids, obviously, you know, we know those are in the development, but to not really have anything on the radar for this, I don't think it needs crazy motion controls. I don't think it needs touchscreen stuff. It's just like, just make a cool futuristic racing game, slap on some online stuff that makes it, you know, at least on par with what they've done with Mario Kart. Make, you know, make an easy mode, make a battle mode with some weapons and stuff like that, and keep it as is.
That was me playing, by the way. I totally remember that. It's ancient, but I love doing the spin around the square curves thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just that game feels so good.
Mm-hmm.
So cool.
I'm wondering if maybe they're not confident that their online structure can support a multiplayer game like this that is so fast. I mean, so
precise too. It's different from Mario Kart, right?
Yeah,
right.
Fast and precise. I'm thinking, how disappointed I was thinking this actually might work with a game like this, one of those battle royale games that they've been experimenting with. If they put everyone on their own track and it's an elimination game, and the better you do, the worse it gets for everyone else. I mean,
that net code for a fast paced racer would be really gnarly. And,
yeah.
And
unless it's 16-bit.
Nintendo can't get 4-player Mario multiplayer running reliably online. Mario Kart's actually pretty damn good, right? But it is a little bit more forgiving. Yeah. I don't know. Like I agree it would be hard to do, but they could easily do a 4-player battle mode that's online if they can't nail like 32 players on track or something.
Oh yeah.
And I really think of F-Zero as more of a single player solitary experience, you versus the track rather than you versus other players. So I don't think missing an online mode would be detrimental to it, but it would obviously help.
But I think, look, we talked about it. I think there are a couple of paths. Like, they could do an F-Zero collection with the classic games, engage whether people are interested, and really play up Captain Falcon. They could re-release GX in widescreen. That game is gorgeous, and tweak it a little bit. Or, you know, like, my dream would be go back to Toshihiro Nagoshi, who's, you know, say, hey, don't make your next game Yakuza, make your next game a new F-Zero on Switch. Or if all of that is not attractive enough, go with this tiny indie studio in Germany, Shin'en. Fast RMX is a really good looking game, and it clearly is an homage to F-Zero in everything. And I think with a little bit more of a budget, and, you know, the classic music from F-Zero and some collaboration with Nintendo, they could make a new F-Zero game that would be really, really cool.
Mm-hmm. And I really do think it would sell. Oh, go ahead, Brian.
No, you go.
I do think it would sell right now. I think we're kind of in the perfect storm for Nintendo right now. I mean, Perry, you alluded to it, like Pikmin. How many times do we see a Switch release where it's like blank is the best selling in blank series of all time? Like Paper Mario was the fastest selling, Origami King on Switch, Pikmin 3, all these series that aren't huge for Nintendo, and it's like F-Zero has sold just horrifically in the past. But I think you really play up Captain Falcon, slap him on the cover, and I think that the hardcore fans will rise up, get the word out online, and I think people will pick it up. I mean, we've seen a lot of this with series lately, like Monster Hunter took off with Monster Hunter World, huge in Japan before that, but now it's a worldwide phenomenon because of a few tweaks and just a great marketing campaign and word of mouth. I think Yakuza is the same.
Fire thing. Emblem
Yakuza's
too.
Huge now. Yeah. So remember, I think it's the right time.
We were, you know, we were already, most of us were working here already when Fire Emblem was not a thing in the United States or the West, right? Where it was like, it'll never take off over here. And now Fire Emblem is such a hit franchise for them. I think the risk when Nintendo doesn't refresh its games, its game franchise, and obviously they're keeping F-Zero around, like through Smash inclusion and all that. But when they don't keep a franchise alive, life will find a way. We're getting Advance Wars clones out there that are really, really good. And like, I wish Nintendo had talked to that team and just said, hey, make an Advance Wars for us. And you're getting, just yesterday announced, Giles Goddard, who was the lead on 1080 snowboarding, is now working on Carve snowboarding, which is exactly 1080, but for the Oculus Quest headsets in VR. And that he used to work at EAD Nintendo Kyoto, and like, nothing stood in the way of Nintendo saying, Giles, can you make 1080 for us? Other than Nintendo, you know, maybe they're feeling spread thin and it's just a lot of projects at the same time.
Mm-hmm. I also think it's not a whole lot of risk, especially because Captain Falcon has been so prominent in the Smash series since the very beginning. I mean, Super Smash Bros. Has basically taught people Nintendo history, and Captain Falcon has been very prominent in all of that. I mean, everyone knows who Captain Falcon is. Everyone knows the prominent theme song because of Smash, and because of that, I think people would be way more willing to jump into a series that hasn't been around for that long, especially if it's on the Switch.
You've got boost power.
I need to
Look at the levels. Smash games, F-Zero games.
Look at the levels. It's insane. Oh, it's just so
cool. Like it's straight up like industrial evil Mario Kart. It's kind of awesome. Like,
Logan, can you repeat that?
I said that Captain Falcon's basically been as many Smash games as F-Zero games at this point. He's more of an F-Zero character or a Smash Bros. Character?
Well, I mean, the last F-Zero game was Mario Kart 8. Yeah. You know, it's got a nice stage in it, and like, they did a really nice job, and it was just kind of like this tantalizing look of what it could have been on Wii U. So just do that.
Honestly, you might be right, Pear. Maybe they feel that the Mario Kart 8 took a lot of the best ideas from F-Zero in terms of track design and brought it into a different direction and kind of owned that space. And maybe they're just looking at F-Zero being like, how do we make this sort of visually identifiable from Mario Kart? Like, outside of the fact that these look like, you know, spaceships rather than plumbers driving around like with their pudgy butts hanging out and throwing. It's like, it's obviously very clearly a different game, but in terms of track design, like, there's a lot of similarities now.
But that's maybe where, if you have a template that works in the Mario Kart realm, can you go to a team like Shinen and say, hey, we want you to take the look of what you did with Fast RMX and look at F-Zero GX and do something like it, and then kind of add some more playful Nintendo factors to it that make it identifiable as F-Zero and not Mario Kart. And then, I mean, look, if a new Mario Kart was out now, it'd be the best-selling game of the year, right? Like, they're obviously, but without a new Mario Kart, Mario Kart 8 will be one of the best-selling games of the year still. So,
yeah, I honestly, like, and we've been saying this for years, but I really wish Nintendo would take some of their IPs and collaborate with, you know, third-party studios that sort of spiritually feel aligned with their vision and creativity and the sort of history of these games. Like, there are so many great studios out there that could be making sort of like the second and third tier, you know, not your Marios and your Zeldas, although I'd love to see a 2D Zelda made by, you know, like the Shovel Knight team or something like that. But like the idea of giving a game like this to a studio like that makes perfect sense. And I wish they would do it. It'd be super cool.
And then for the Sega thing, I looked up on whether there was bad blood between Sega and Nintendo around F-Zero. It's hard to get, you know, Japanese developers to go on the record, which is why this interview is so cool that we've got here. You know, after he quit Nintendo, that he opened up about things. There were a couple of things we cut out of the interview that I thought were really interesting. They weren't news stories, but like nice little color stories about how they work. But like, so Toshihiro Nagoshi once said in a Famitsu interview that he would have quit the industry if he had started at Nintendo rather than Sega.
Oh, what? Wow.
Yeah. And so that sounds like there is something around how the collaboration worked and, you know, what he wanted to do rather than what Nintendo wanted to do on GX. So maybe there's still some lingering bad blood and the two will never come together again.
I mean,
which is a shame. He made two, I would say, top five GameCube games, F-Zero GX, and then Monkey Ball 1 and 2, which are incredible on GameCube and the peak of that series.
I think also, like, we're in a different era for Nintendo now. I think that they've loosened up a little bit over the last few years. I mean, they let, you know, Davide Soliani and Ubisoft give Mario a gun. Like, we're, you know, things have changed a little bit. It's also like, I think that, like, probably working for Nintendo or working alongside collaborating with Nintendo back then was probably a lot tougher than it is now. I mean, not that they don't have style guides and stuff now, but if you look at even like when, you know, that Nintendo infused Scribblenauts game came out, which was all about adding adjectives to characters, changing their attributes. Nintendo was like, you can't do that to you. You know, you can't make zombie Luigi and you can't make old Peach or anything like that. So, like, I think things have changed a little bit. They're opening up a lot more. They've got theme parks and action figure lines. They're collaborating with more people. There's Musou games now. Like, there's just, like, I think that, like, this is a different era now. And so I really hope that there's, like, another approach to the collaboration here. Because I think it could work more now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it was good to hear that he said it's not dead yet. And, you know, maybe that means there were discussions. Maybe there were discussions. It is hard. That game is hard, too. Thank you. Maybe that means that they had lots of discussions around F-Zero, and, you know, we'll eventually get one, which is more than can be said for Advance Wars, where the last life sign was in the 1800s.
Yeah.
Yeah, 1895 was the last time it was mentioned.
Yeah, you just wonder if it feels like they think it's just too similar to Mario Kart, which, I mean, you play them and they're completely different. But, I mean, Advance Wars, too similar to Fire Emblem. Maybe it's just disappointing to see these series that could be really great kind of overshadowed by other series in similar genres.
All the hover and flight parts, the big jumps were added to Mario Kart. Although Mario Kart is much more on rails when you take off, you know, when you compare it to this. Like, yeah. You can really kill yourself all in all sorts of spectacular ways in this yeah. game. Like, you think you have the perfect shortcuts and yep. you're gone.
I mean, yeah. I guess, like, in the meantime, the original Super Nintendo F-Zero is available on the SNES Online app. So if you do want to play an F-Zero game on your Switch, you have that. I also recommend Fast RMX. I mentioned it before. It launched alongside the Switch, and it's super, super cool. It's about as close as we've gotten to sort of like an exclusive, you know, futuristic F-Zero style racing game on a Nintendo platform in a while.
Shinen is one of those studios where I feel like Nintendo should have just bought them already. Like,
totally.
The Tourist, mm-hmm. if that is kind of like, it has almost a charm of like a Paper Mario where they kind of mess with the shapes of figures. Like, if that was like Mario or Nintendo themed in some way, it would be a huge success. And mm-hmm. it's a small studio. They should grab them.
They also have an awesome history of sort of like getting the most power out of, you know, traditionally underpowered Nintendo handhelds and consoles. Like, they were always there, like almost day one, to be like, here's what you can do on the Nintendo DS. It's like a 3D shmup and it's gorgeous and it's got, you know, like it looks like mini ray tracing, basically. Like, they're an amazing studio. I hope they get to work with Nintendo more.
Well, hopefully we will see more from F-Zero, or like from Nintendo showing F-Zero sometime in the near future. But we did have some questions from everyone at the Nintendo Podcast Forums Facebook group. I think you guys have already answered some of these questions. For example, Richard asked if we think Nintendo lacks the necessary hardware for a proper F-Zero sequel, and mentions the lack of analog triggers. We've already talked about the 30-player online scenario, but what do you think about the lack of analog triggers affecting F-Zero?
I don't think that's an issue. I think the biggest factor in the F-Zero games is the shoulder button drifts, rather than any sort of nuance with the accelerator.
Yeah. Like, well, so F-Zero does the Joy-Con, usually, so that works perfectly.
F-Zero is usually full power. Yeah, it'll drift. That's right. Right? Like, what do you think, Logan? Like, it doesn't feel like analog is that important, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think about drifting on the SNES, and they just had the shoulder button. So, right. Yeah, I don't think that's really an inhibitor.
Yeah, the GameCube obviously had really cool triggers, but yeah. I don't feel like they were essential for GX the way it would be for, you know, like a Gran Turismo or something like that.
Mm-hmm. I also wanted to mention the Magnum Molo, the special edition controller, feels better than the original Pro controller. I really don't know why or what. The D-pad feels like it works better. The triggers feel like less likely you're going to accidentally press them, and it feels a little bit heavier. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe I'm just imagining things. I have an original one. Like, compare. I should weigh them. I'll weigh them and come back next week and let you know.
That's a really good idea. I have to compare them. Yeah.
It's a
beautiful controller either way.
I just wonder if they just made some small changes and didn't bother to say anything about it. But next question is from Evan Beedolf, and they ask, Pear, and also I'm going to extend this to Logan, I know you're a fan of this F-Zero. What do you like most about the series and why?
Well, at first, when I first played it, it was kind of like this demonstration of the Super Nintendo hardware where you realized what a big step up it was, right? Like, how clever it was to just tilt the playing field and have like use it for this maximum speed. But the thing that I always loved the most is how smooth and how fast the franchise is. And when we got to F-Zero X, when we saw the first screenshots of that game on the N64, it looked so much less detailed than most racing games that were coming out. And then you play it and you realize how impressive it is to see this field of all these racers ahead of you, like being really part of this giant pack of cars. That was something that we didn't really have in a lot of games. And I still love that to date, where you like your position 32 and you hit your boost and like your counter goes like 31, 31, 19, 46, you know, like you're like, like this kind of this excitement of pack racing. And then, you know, you kind of smash into them and knock a couple out. It just, I love that feel.
What about you, Logan?
Yeah, there's a couple things about it I love. I'm a huge racing fan, IndyCar racing. I've been watching that since I was a kid. And when I first played F-Zero, I was like, this feels like watching IndyCar racing. Like, it's so fast and so technical. And there's just, it's Nintendo just doesn't make anything like that anymore. And I love that about it. And just the push and pull, the risk reward system, specifically in like GX or X, where your boost is tied to your health bar. So when you're boosting and your health is depleting and you're like, I can see first place, but my car is about to explode. Do I go for it here or not? And just that split second decision making on just these rapidly fast tracks is just so much fun. And learning a course too, like, you're so bad at it the first time you do it. You're just awful. And going back and getting better is something I wish that 3D Sonic felt like when I played it too, and it never has. And I'm like, it could take some lessons from F-Zero.
So that GX, when you watch some of the footage, by the way, like, sometimes it looks like somebody's fast forwarding this game. Like, you're watching the footage and you're like, it can't be that fast. You can't react it. But like, as you play the game, you really get that good with the reaction times and how you learn the courses. And like, it seems improbable when you first see it that you could ever master a level, but with a lot of time you can.
And it feels so good when you do.
So good.
I really think recently games have been going away from making game design where you have to repeatedly do something before you're able to do it. I know I'm saying that as a Monster Hunter fan. I know that is a thing in Monster Hunter. But as far as like full levels of like needing to memorize like where to go and what to do and exact your timing in order to succeed, I like, as a kid, like, platformers were kind of like that for me. Like, you'd have to memorize things before you could master the level, and until then you would just like fumble through it. But I also, this kind of segues into this question from Patrick, and we kind of touched on this before as well, but does F-Zero need a Lakitu to help put players back on the track when they crash, or are the high stakes part of the appeal?
100% it needs, because it is incredibly frustrating if you're on like lap four of a race and you misjudge the jump slightly and you bounce off the barrier and you're dead and it's retired. And like, an entire championship can be ruined that way. And it does get so frustrating. I do think the risk reward could still be there with a boost meter. Like, if your ship blows up, that should be it. Like, your ship should be done. And so like, being able to play it dangerously and really pushing your boost and bringing your shield down to nothing, I think that should, the punishment for that should be death. But for falling out, they should give you a time penalty.
Yeah, or like a boost penalty, like drop your health bar to half if you fall off the edge, or something like that could work.
Or even just have a variation of difficulties. I mean, Fire Emblem has had it, like, have permadeath on or not. So just have it on, just a toggle of on or off if you want to have it on.
Or have a mode. Like that or not. There are modes where you knock out enemies like a death race style. They could still have permadeath in that, you know.
I think there's a lot of different ways they can go around it and make it pleasing to a huge variety of old fans and then also appeal to new players as well. But I wanted to move on to some other parts of the interview. Like I said, I implore everyone to go read it. It's very interesting. The interview, again, was with the ex-designer Takuya Imamura. He worked there for 30 years and he has so many tidbits. He considers F-Zero GX to be the ultimate F-Zero, which I think all of you already agreed with wholeheartedly.
Yeah, and I do. He
also mentioned, I had no idea that games made back on the Super Nintendo and even the Nintendo 64 were made on incredibly small teams, so between like 10 and 30 people. And one of the things that struck out to me from the interview was how he worked on A Link to the Past. And he's credited as an object designer, and objects in a video game are things that aren't part of the background, so the thing that you can pick up and interact with. However, he also designed almost all of the bosses, and that wasn't just the art, it was also the mechanics. He would sit down and work with a designer or programmer, and together they would come up with the mechanics for those. And I think this is really interesting because we learned from the interview that he started at Nintendo as an artist wanting to provide art for booklets, because his aspirations were to become a manga artist. And then he gets thrown onto the research and development team and is asked to make games now. And it just is really interesting how back then teams were so small that you would kind of help every sense of the way. And I just thought that was very interesting.
Well, the cool thing is that all of his items did end up in booklets.
So. Oh, yeah, that's true.
He just had to design the whole game first. I mean, you know.
So, but was there anything else that kind of stood out to you guys from that interview that you want to mention?
I can mention one of the parts that we left out because there was a lot and a lot of it was color and not giving you too much insight, but he described working with Rare. Like he was the guy who had to go out to Twycross, to England to visit Rare during the creation of some of the games like Star Fox Adventures. And he was just recalling how he stayed, it was like the absolute countryside, and Rare's offices were beautiful, but the hotel he stayed at looked exactly like Luigi's Mansion, and it was just creaky and creepy and old, and the shower had no hot water. And like, when you think about that and you're like, here's a top designer who's made these giant games, and he's like staying in this really crappy little bed and breakfast to go to visit the company that made GoldenEye. It's just such a It's interesting because you got to think that, you know, there's a certain amount of humility with people like him who work behind the scenes and work on these big games still.
Mm-hmm. Again, everyone should go read the full interview on IGN.com. We will link it in the description and in the article. It's really cool. Go do that. But moving on to our next topic, thank you all three of you for that amazingly insightful F-Zero discussion. I'm very glad that we finally got to do that. Thank you, Logan, for setting that up.
This year I decided I actually wanted to like follow hockey a little bit more than just the most casual of casuals, so I subscribed to a service that streams all of the NHL to your television. The Boston Bruins home opener, I went to watch it, and boom, blackout restrictions apply, which I thought was kind of ridiculous because I'm still 200 miles away from Boston, but whatever. Had I had NordVPN, that wouldn't have been a problem. I would have just gone in, changed my settings to another geographic area, and boom, I could have been watching all the Boston Bruins home games like it was nothing at all. So now I have NordVPN, and I can watch the home games of my local teams streaming without being frustrated. It's the same thing with like Netflix. It has all these complicated licensing rules, which from one country to another don't really make sense. So something you could watch on South Korean Netflix, you won't be able to watch on the United States Netflix unless NordVPN, boom, switch to South Korea, and you're watching whatever Korean drama that you want. I highly recommend you do that. I haven't done it myself, but people seem to enjoy them. And who am I to try to bring down people's enjoyment? NordVPN, more than just entertainment and sports availability, it's going to protect you, especially when you're traveling, when you're using public Wi-Fi. People are trying to get in there. They're creeping on you. Bad actors, people trying to steal your password, your bank account details. Who knows what the government's doing these days? I can't keep track. They're all over the damn place. NordVPN, it's going to protect you. It's going to protect up to 6 devices, because I know you have at least that many devices in front of you right now that can hook up to the internet. Boom. Fastest VPN in the world. You're not going to get any buffering. You're not going to get any lagging. It's going to stop your ISP from bandwidth throttling, which they do. That's kind of sneaky, especially how much you're paying those guys. There's threat protection to protect you from viruses and malicious malware and whatever else. Unsavory actors are out there. If you want to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/NintendoVC. That's nordvpn.com/NintendoVC. Victor Charlie. That link is also going to give you 4 extra months on the 2-year plan. There is no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. That's nice of them, and I appreciate that.
Do you like science fiction? I'm Carrie Bechet, and if you loved movies like Arrival or Interstellar, then you're going to want to check out my podcast, Hypothetical. On Hypothetical, we tell speculative sci-fi stories interwoven with real science. New episodes every Tuesday, available wherever you get podcasts.
And for topic number 2, the Great Ace Attorney Chronicles has officially been announced for the PS4, Switch, and PC.
I am so excited for this. Oh my goodness.
Good. I'm glad. Just as a quick summary, this bundles together 2015's The Great Ace Attorney and its 2017 sequel together in a single package. These were originally Japan exclusive 3DS games. So once again, we are provided with proof that Nintendo can port 3DS games to the Switch. Please do that more. But yeah, no one in the US has been able to play this yet. And it will have dual audio support, so you can play with the English dub or Japanese, and these are prequels set in the Victorian era. Why are you... it's so cool. Yeah,
I love it. I never got to play these two. I don't know, Logan, did you play them? They were only in Japanese, but like just... looking at the trailers back when it was announced, like the main character is called Yuonosuke Nosuke Naruhodo, which means of course, right? So it's just super punny. What was it, Herlock Sholmes. And Iris Wilson, she's not a doctor apparently, but still. And it's set in the Japanese Meiji era, right, which is our Victorian age. It's just so funny that they did a full prequel to the Ace Attorney. I can't wait to play this.
Yeah, Ace Attorney is my favorite game series of all time, hands down. Wow. I love this franchise. I've been playing them since I was in elementary school. And I wanted to be a lawyer for a long time. I think it was probably because of this. Now that I'm older, I know that's not realistic at all, what goes on in those courtrooms, obviously. But yeah, it's been almost 5 years since an Ace Attorney game has come over here. Spirit of Justice on 3DS was the last one, and I didn't think these things were ever going to get brought over. I thought these were going to just stay in Japan. There's a number of reasons I didn't think they were going to be brought over. The character is just Sherlock Holmes in the Japanese version. Now for the localization, he's Herlock Sholmes. For years and years, the localization team has tried to make it look like Ace Attorney takes place in the U.S., but it's obviously not. I mean, they're
but it's main so Japanese.
Yeah, it is so Japanese. And now they're saying screw it. I mean, they didn't even change the names. Like, these are Japanese names for the main characters. So I think they're kind of abandoning that idea. But this is just so exciting. I'm curious about some of the localization. I played a fan translation of the first one, and there are some things I don't think would fly over here. Sherlock Holmes can be, I'd say, a little bit racist at times. He's like a bumbling fool in this game, is kind of how he's played.
Well, that's Herlock Sholmes for you.
Exactly. So I'm really curious, having played a few cases of localization, just how different his characterization is going to be. I thought that was a big hurdle for it coming over here. But I just can't wait for this.
I love these games. I'm like, with each one, I fall in love with the games, despite the limitations that don't seem to be going away. Like, there's sometimes cases where you know the answer, but you can't figure out the game system to signal it to the courtroom the right way, right? Like, you think you're flagging the right thing, and it goes, no, that's not it, brr, and everybody's sad, and, you know. And I'm hoping we get to a point where this franchise is so successful in the West where they do consider a serious upgrade, where we'll get a fully animated, full voice version, and then on top of it, some game systems that are a little bit more involved, like instead of like the kind of hidden object, like still shots, more of an exploration of the crime scenes and stuff. But I love all of these games, and like, I do think the characters are so outrageous, and every trial ends with the real culprit being in the courtroom, of course, and being accused instead of the person who is obviously not guilty, and it's just so great.
I know that it says in our article that this is new to the Great Ace Attorney. There's an expanded jury system and a little bit more involvement of persuading the jury member. So it's not the same thing. It's not as involved as described, but there is something additional that weren't in the other games.
There are small things that improve, right? Mm-hmm. Like Logan, for example, like you can look at the facial expressions of characters change when they get nervous. Like, that wasn't in the originals, that have been added over the years. But I haven't seen the system yet, what that looks
like. The late Ace Attorney crossover messed with that too. It introduced a jury stand that had like five people, and there's a guy on the left, and you're like, where were you at this time? And he's like, oh, I was here. And then someone on the far right is like, oh, and then you're like, why'd you just freak out about that?
That's right.
Just kind of monitor every witness. So this is pretty similar to that. And it's Shu Takami, who is the creator of Ace Attorney, stepped aside after the fourth game, wrote Leighton Ace Attorney, and he actually came back to Capcom to write these two games. So this is the original writer of the original trilogy, which people hands down think is the best Ace Attorney there is.
That's great.
I am very excited for these, because I've been recently looking for more games that aren't necessarily action games, but would still keep me engaged. And this looks Perfect for that. So this package will be coming out on July 27th this year for PS4, Switch, and PC via Steam. And it includes both the games, The Great Ace Attorney and its sequel. So very cool. I'm excited for this. I'm also very glad that all of you are excited. July is looking extremely busy now. What are we getting in July? Monster Hunter Stories. We're getting this game. We're getting Skyward Sword. There was another JRPG coming out in July that I'm...
World Ends With You is also coming
out. There we go. The World Ends With You. But there's so many games coming out in July. I can't do it. Stop.
When are we... Famicom Detective Club, that's in... When is that? May,
That's
right?
in May, that's and now I'm a lot less inclined to play those.
I'm hoping a demo comes out for those other games.
I think we're at the cusp of some of the games that were traditionally only popular in Japan just getting bigger and bigger here. And it started really with Fire Emblem, and I hope it's... And Yakuza obviously is following in those tracks. I hope it continues.
I know that it's probably not a completely direct correlation, but look at how much more popular anime has gotten over here in recent years. I mean, I remember growing up, the only way to watch it was guess I'm going to watch what Cartoon Network has on, and four kids and WB, and that was basically it. The selection was almost nothing. So if you met another anime fan, odds were they were watching the same stuff you were. Yep. But now we have so many streaming services, and so many people are interested in that form of entertainment that I feel like games like Ace Attorney and Detective Club would appeal to a broader audience just because anime is so much more prevalent and readily available now. So let's move on to more news, though. Thank you again for talking about The Great Ace Attorney Chronicles. But in more news, I know we already mentioned Super Monkey Ball as another Sega game that came out on the Nintendo series, but a previously unannounced game has been rated in Australia. It's called Super Monkey Ball Banana Mania. And the last Super Monkey Ball game was Super Monkey Ball Banana Blitz HD, which came in 2019, but that was an up-res of a Wii game. So it's been a while since we got I'm with you. I loved the GameCube Super Monkey Ball. I beat that game multiple times. It was incredibly fun. We're going to get a new Super Monkey Ball game? Will it be good?
The title Banana Mania, it just sounds like Banana Blitz and Banana Splits, which are really bad Monkey Ball games. That series plummeted downhill after the first two entries on GameCube, and I mean, there's been rumors of a return to form for this series. The announcer, the Ready Go, he's been saying, oh, we're making something special for classic Monkey Ball fans. But now Banana Mania, awesome. We'll see. I don't know. Yeah, I'm a little worried about it.
We were talking before about the F-Zero and Star Fox franchises overthinking the sort of core philosophy of why people enjoy these games. Monkey Ball did the exact same thing. To me, once they introduced a jump and a bunch of other kind of useless mechanics, a lot of stuff that was, hinged around waggle controls and touchscreen controls, and they kind of lost the plot. Monkey Ball 1 and 2 are certified classics. They are two of the best sort of action puzzle games ever made. Watching people speed run those things is sublime. It is one of my favorite things in the world. I'd still go back and play them every time I get a chance. I would love a port of those two games on Switch. I feel like when they reintroduced Monkey Ball to Nintendo Switch, they picked the wrong one. It was
they just picked the best selling one.
Yeah, which is, I mean, it's because bizarre.
That was on the Wii.
It was on the Wii, yeah.
I feel like the jump is a fundamental misunderstanding of the control system. It's you're not the monkey. You're the world. You're in charge of the world. And introducing a jump, the environment can make you jump already, right?
That's the whole point.
That's the thing that it just doesn't work in that game. I actually did back with the original, some of the little mini games that they introduced, the kind of gliding stuff. There were a lot of good ideas.
Real quick, just for anyone who may not be familiar with Monkey Ball, the whole point is so it's like that one shrine in The Legend of Zelda and Breath of the Wild where you're controlling a big ball, but you use the Switch motion controls to control the actual, how the level is tilting. So you were trying to get the ball to go where you wanted to go, and that's how Monkey Ball works. But you can do quick movements with it to get them to jump, and your whole point is to get to the end of the level without the monkey ball falling off the level.
And yep. along the way, you have, you know, the option of collecting bananas. As many bananas as you want. And like, you know, there's items and power ups here and there and stuff like that. But
so many secrets, like
hidden, so many secrets. Yeah.
Hidden places. But
like what's interesting about this is that it's effectively this franchise is the spiritual successor to like a very ancient marble rolling concept. Right. Starting from games like Marble Madness, which like got modernized tons of times over the year, but were always devoid of personality. There are always these sort of like cold, you know, mechanical, this is just like a 3D rendered ball rolling around a maze. Whereas Monkey Ball was the first one to be like, oh, you get to pick a different character. They scream when they die. You know, like there's boss fights sometimes, which we don't really want. We don't necessarily need those things. Yeah, but but there'll also be mini games that were like the kind of mini games where you could legit spend as much time playing them. Like Monkey Target, and I forget the one that was sort of like a almost like a Mario Party minigame where four players were on like a flat thing. They had to knock each other off.
Oh, yeah, monkey boxing, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Like stuff fun. Like that, that. It's really fun. And I really think that there's a chance here for like this to really succeed on Switch. And I think that like it was kind of like boneheaded of them to take the most or the best selling one and port it to Switch. It's. Yeah. You know, it's one of those like things where like the thermometer's off, right? Like it's that thing EA always does where they're like, oh, like we're going to test the waters with like a FIFA game. And you're like, do something better.
I mean, maybe they just did that because it was easier to port because it looked better.
For sure.
Probably.
For sure.
But so we all agree, make it good again. And then number two, I and Smash.
Mm-hmm.
Just,
yeah. Oh, hey.
Wow, awesome.
Roll over all those fools, man.
I got a couple things I want to add real quick. Mm-hmm. Also, the party games in Banana Blitz, they had 50 of them, and they're all really bad. And, like, you go back to 2, and it's like there's 10 amazing party
good.
Games.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's just so much that's better about 1 and 2 that, man, it's just my week on NBC. Ace Attorney, Monkey Ball, F-Zero, it's all fantastic.
There you go.
And I think about other Marble games, just like I think about other visual novels and other futuristic racers, and it's like, man, Monkey Ball just does it so right compared to the other games in that genre. And just those first two games are just like lightning in a bottle for that series. And I just need it to come back. And a game I need to shout out is, have any of you heard of Rolled Out?
Mm-mm.
That's the recent one that came to Steam, correct?
Yeah. It is a spiritual successor to Super Monkey Ball 1 and 2. It's in early access right now on Steam. It is a group of Monkey Ball super fans who love the first two, don't like the direction the series went, and are recapturing those two games. And I have played it, and it feels like 1 and 2. It is so good. If you love classic Monkey Ball, you should go check it out. It's $20 on Steam, and it's like a front runner for my game of the year right now. It's
wow.
That's awesome.
I know you guys already mentioned this, but I love this resurgence of diehard fans making games, because the original developers aren't coming out with them fast enough or with what they want to see, like with Stardew Valley. And as you mentioned, what was the Advance Wars one? Oh my goodness, it has a dog.
Wargroove.
Yeah. It's the one with and all of those other games. So that's really awesome. It's cool to see.
I mean, this is a painting with a you know, like a large brush here, but I feel like there's a better track record of that happening than it is when, for the most part, the original creators makes a spiritual successor. And it's, you know, like if you look at Mighty No. 9, Balan Wonderland, like there's been a lot of scenarios like that where someone's like, I'm gonna recapture that amazing thing I did. But also, like, I'm completely disconnected from why people like that to begin with. Whereas I feel like fans sometimes are more in tune with that. But then again, they can't use any of the original characters or likenesses. So they can't. I mean, they should have just put different animals in the ball, honestly.
Super hippo ball.
That's what they do in Rolled Out. It's a little rat that runs around right now.
Yeah. Oh, really?
That makes sense.
Oh, great. Perfect. There we go.
That's all we need. That's all we need.
Straight up Monkey Ball without the monkeys. Just a ton of other animals.
Rat ball. No. sorry. Also, we finally, I guess not finally, but we did get news that Lego Luigi is coming. So as an expansion to the Super Mario Lego sets, it was actually leaked with an update, and then they just went ahead and officially announced it. But it's coming out on August 1st. It is available for pre-order. The starter course is $59.99, and the set includes 280 pieces and can, of course, be combined with all previous Lego Super Mario sets. Do any of you have any of these Lego sets, Brian? I feel like this is a you joint.
I collect like weird Mario figures, so I was tempted to get it for that, but I haven't picked it up. I like, to me, I'm still a little irked that they didn't go with a traditional minifig thing on this one. I understand they wanted to bring in the sort of playable video game aspect to it. It seems like the kind of thing that, like, if you get a ton of sets, it's probably a blast. But the base $60 set of just Mario didn't really interest me. That said, I really like what they're doing here. Like, it's this look has really grown on me. Like, I appreciate how toyetic this is for Lego, which traditionally does a lot of stuff that is sort of like the fun is building it. And then you look at it and you carefully move it from place to place for the rest of your life and hope it doesn't drop. Whereas in this scenario, like, this is all about sort of tearing it down and bringing it back up. One cool thing about this Lego Luigi is I believe he's like the exact same form factor as Mario, but the way they designed his face makes him look sort of longer and leaner and a little more like sort of narrow, which I think that's really clever. But yeah, I don't know, if like I walked into a store and there was like 15 of these sets on clearance and I brought them home and built an entire Mario level with my kid, I think that'd be a blast. But like, I think we did the math on IGN a couple years ago, or when these were first announced, about like how much money it would cost to sort of buy all of them, which obviously they don't expect you to do. But between the sort of like deliberate sets and the blind bags of characters and enemies and stuff like that, it gets into the, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollar range. So that said, you don't need them all, but it's cool that they're making them.
I have some of them.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I have some of them. It's definitely, you know, I have a lot of Lego in the house and I actively enjoy the more complex builds, whether it's Star Wars or some of the space stuff that Lego does. This is very simplistic. Like, the builds are very, very simple, and the hook is that sort of interaction, like the feedback you get from the figure, like touching things. So it is, I would say, Brian, like, your kid, you know, once she gets older, she'll really like this. But as a kind of like a Mario fan collector, it doesn't get me too excited just because it's so simple. I would love to see like a really intricately designed track, you know, like level, something like that.
I also think it's kind of an adult tendency to feel like, oh, like it comes with this one thing, but I feel like I need all of the things to really appreciate it. Whereas children don't have that. Like, you give them one thing and they will love that and get entertainment out of it for hours and hours and hours. At least speaking from my experience as a child, I don't know how children work nowadays. It might be totally different. But when I was a kid, like, I had like two or three games for the Super Nintendo, and I didn't even think to ask for more or be disappointed that I didn't have more of those things. Same things with Lego sets and everything. I just was happy with what I had and entertained myself.
Well, the sort of like Kinder Egg surprise blind box blind bag culture thing now is you know, it was definitely around when we were younger, but it is so much more prevalent now. So it's very interesting because it preys into the idea that maybe you don't need them all, but you're still going to buy a lot because you want one or two specific ones. There's also like, I don't know if, I mean, you guys have probably seen this, but on YouTube, there's like thousands of videos of kids just opening up blind bag, blind box toys and being like, I wonder what I got. You know, you probably most recently saw that with Pokemon cards, is sort of like scratching that same itch. And so I don't know, when I was a kid, I was like, I need every Ghostbuster, I need every Ninja Turtle. And my parents were like, no. Or they were like, you can do chores and, you know, earn money over the course of 5 years until you grow out of these things and collect them individually. But no, I think you're right, Casey. I think there's less of an impetus to get every single one. And that is definitely more of an adult trait. Right, Pear?
Well, we were just briefly talking about this for there's a Monster Hunter board game Kickstarter, and you can get the base like of the board game for like not that expensive. How much was it? Like $50 or $60 for a board game that's not, for a really intricate board game that is not actually that expensive. However, to get all of it, it's $300, which is quite expensive. And I'm like, well, if I'm not going to get the $300 version, I don't want it.
it does have Casey dragons both in, you know,
I want the Elder dragons,
very big miniatures in it.
I want it. But last piece of news for this week, bypassing that, so we just got word. I was so excited about this when I heard about this morning, like just ecstatic. I immediately like brought up those links to buy this thing, and that thing is The Instax Mini Link, which is a smartphone photo printer, is getting a Nintendo Switch app that will let you print your photos, like the ones you're going to take in new Pokemon Snap, or maybe those photos you took of you and your friends hanging out in Animal Crossing. And I love it so much. And you can do a bunch of different designs, and it's going to be an official app, which also means you can decorate your regular photos with Nintendo themed characters and borders and everything as well. And it is coming out. So this printer is actually already available. The app just won't be available until the 30th. However, on April 30th, the same day the new Pokemon Snap is coming out, there will be a bundle that includes a little protector for the Instax Mini, which is it's like a little tiny handheld Polaroid printer. So you get those really small Polaroids that you can print from it, and it connects to your phone, so you can print out all of your regular photos as well. And it comes with like a little Pikachu case that makes it look like a Pikachu. Mm. And it also comes with this new color called Ash White. And I mean, obviously it's just white with some like red and blue details, but it's based off, you know, the same colors as Ash from the Pokemon anime. I am not going to wait for the special edition one, because I feel like these are going to be sold out immediately.
Instax.
Yeah. So yeah, it's Instax. It's Instax. It's actually a part of a Fujifilm's line. My biggest question is, will this app work with other printers that are not the Instax Mini Link?
Hmm.
And I don't know the answer to that question, but that is my biggest question.
Probably not, but and a lot of people don't know this, you can print photos in 2021.
Well, yeah,
this is so funny to me. This is where like we boomerang so like we are now nostalgic for stuff that we've made obsolete 15 years ago. It's hilarious
Game Boy
to me,
printer.
Yeah, this. So we had the Game Boy printer back in the day, which you could take photos on the Game Boy camera and then print on. You had to get these proprietary paper ribbon, you know, which was great. I believe there's like these weird like ink cartridge things or whatever. But you can theoretically right now get a photo printer on Amazon. I know it doesn't have like the cutesy form factor of this thing that looks sort of like a humidifier or something like that. It's an AirPods case. Small.
Could you put a Pikachu sticker on it though, Brian? Could you do that?
No. Okay. But yeah, you could theoretically take pictures on your or take screen caps on your Switch and then send them, your tweet them or like save them to an SD card, put the SD card in your computer and print the photos. That's you've had that power for a very long time now.
That's so annoying.
I know. But I am very happy. I'm very happy that like we are now nostalgic for tangible photographs again. We have been for a while, right? Like there's actually Polaroid has had a sort of a resurgence in the same way vinyl has over the last 10 or so years, where people are just like, I take all these pictures. What do I do with them? You know, like photographs used to be like a physical thing. I sound like a senior citizen right now, but I actually really love this. I think it's super cute. It's like if it's like something that, you know, like young adults can use, or it's like some kid's first printer, like the idea of like taking screenshots on your Nintendo Switch and hitting a button and then having like a picture of it is adorable. Like that's I don't know. I think that's really, really special. Even though this is just gonna, like the tech we've had for forever now. It's funny to me.
Is this app gonna make getting my Nintendo Switch screenshots to wikis easier? It might. I don't even need the photo. I don't even need the photo printer to use the app.
Yes, maybe.
I don't like dealing with SD cards. I don't know. I just want to like email them off directly.
Well, you can set up. Yeah,
they made the image sharing easier already, right?
Yeah, like they did. It's a QR code now, right?
Yep. You can.
Casey, what you should do? Set up a like a dummy Twitter account.
Yeah.
And just tweet
make
your
it private and tweet.
Make it like a private Twitter account where you just tweet photos, and then you can take those photos and put them on a wiki or put them on a printer, put them anywhere.
Okay, so I think we've determined you don't technically need this specific product and that specific app, but
it's really cool.
It'll let you edit your photos in unique ways. I'm sure those already exist. You're right. There are other ways to get your Nintendo Switch photos onto your phone or onto your computer into a photo editing app and then use a different printer.
Right, but how many of them come with like a large rubber Pikachu shell? Think about that. Probably very few. I'd say close to zero.
Also, this is it is like the ease factor, right? Like you just scan it. It goes into an app automatically where you can automatically edit and it, you just prints right off of your phone.
It's right? Not the ease factor because you have to buy a printer.
Well, it's $100. It's not.
All right.
It's $100 and it's small. You can put it in a purse, or if you have boy pants, you can put them in a pocket. they're come in cute colors. I don't know, man. I'm trying to, I just want to be able to print my photos. I'll do some research and I will come back next week with my definitive decision. Do you need this particular printer with that particular app? I will do that next week during our presumed new Pokemon Snap review discussion. We will talk about that. The best way.
Two hour special.
The best way to print your new Pokemon Snap photos, all to have a full breakdown, 1600 words. That's really not that long. That's not a long explanation at all. It's like, I don't know, 3 minutes. No, eight minutes of discussion. Anyway, I'm excited. I'm sorry you guys aren't. Maybe I shouldn't be.
I'm not excited. I think it's very cool. I think it's very cool.
I am not excited.
Okay, you're not excited. Yeah.
They think it's useless. That's fine.
Well, okay. So I can't believe
you guys are still talking about this little printer.
The thing is, Pear, for decades now, photos have only existed on your phone, and there's no way to bring them to real life.
No, that's
until
true.
Now with the Instax Mini Link available on April 30th.
It's been out for a year. You can go get one of these right now. It just doesn't have the Nintendo Switch app yet.
I hate you all.
Well,
I think it's cool.
Casey, move on.
I'll move on. I'm sorry. I'm just like, man, I feel like I've been duped by the marketing.
Casey, our listeners dropped to four people and they all work for Instax. Oh, God.
Okay. We're moving on to things that we are playing and reading. Thank you for listening to our news about Super Monkey Ball, Luigi coming to Lego, and this stupid camera that everyone hates. But let's talk about what we're playing and reading. Specifically, I did want to have a brief discussion about Askiwata. I've started reading it. I'm not super far into it. I know that Pear has started to read it. Brian and Logan, have you started to read this book?
Yes. Yeah. I love it. It's like a hug. Like, it's my best way to describe it. It is very, it's like very warm and sweet, and it makes me feel really lucky that we had Iwata and really sad that we don't have him anymore. But it is also like, it's largely about managing a company, which is like really interesting. Like, it is very business corporate, but also from somebody who it doesn't really, I think, was elevated to those roles because he was great at them, but not necessarily because he was like a cutthroat businessman or anything like that. Like, he has a very sort of like hands-on, boots on the ground approach to running a company and management, or did. And a lot of it was sort of like talking to people and seeing what they're good at. He has a line in there that it was sort of just like, companies, the purpose of a company is basically to get a bunch of people together with individual specific skills to create like something that they wouldn't have been able to create alone. And I think that's like fundamentally opposed to a lot of the way like most cutthroat modern businesses run. And it was like really sweet to read that. Like, I think he really genuinely cared about the talents of the people around him and, you know, carefully considered their skills. Yeah, it's like it's a really good book. It's also like it's super brisk read. I think I finished it in like two sittings. So yeah. You can fly through it pretty quick.
Also, just a brief summary. Satoru Iwata was the fourth president and was the CEO of Nintendo. He originally started out at a Hall Laboratories, which like it goes through his like life story a little bit of like how he got involved in programming and how he got started at Hall, and actually ended up taking over Hall when they were in a huge amount of debt, and it was a huge undertaking for him. And one of the things that he began doing was interviewing every single employee twice a year. And he said that those interviews would last somewhere between 30 minutes to upwards of like hours, depending on the conversation. And there's just so many like nuggets of wisdom and advice on how to interact with people in the workplace as either an employee or a manager. And I feel like it is so insightful. But as Brian said, it is not cutthroat at all. It is all about respecting people and like how to interact with people instead of it's not like here's how to run a business. It's like here's how to interact with people for the best wholesome effect.
Yeah, it's a charming book. I finished it as well. The first half of the book, what made the first half of the book special was that it was Iwata speaking. The things he says in the first half to someone like me, I've read a whole bunch of management books, from the bad ones to the helpful ones, and like he echoes a lot of the strategies on how to manage people and how to let people discover, you know, what they're strong at and you know how you encourage your staff. Like a lot of that was echoed and not new to me or didn't sound particularly unique, but even though there's this translator, you can tell there's this humility in this man because he came in as a programmer. And then the second half, I think, is where the book is strongest because it goes to a little bit more of the behind the scenes stories about how he thought about programming and how that helped him as a manager later. And it has some specific examples around the games, like the famous story around Earthbound, where he said it's easier to just start over. So it has that anecdote. And then the last quarter of the book is the best. It's the testimonials from his closest associates, the creator of Mario and the creator of Earthbound, basically giving their feedback on Iwata the man. And it's really, really charming, and it's very sad too. I found there are a whole bunch of quotable things in there. You know, he talks about like the blue ocean strategy and all that stuff and how he discovered that in a management book. But like, I really loved Iwata's take on online games, which is like, you can tell it still pervades how Nintendo thinks about competitive gaming. He says, in my view, the online games of the world are unfairly biased towards the strong. It takes the bad luck. It takes the bad luck of 100 or 1,000 players to make a single player happy.
Ooh, oh, wow. Yeah.
So good. That is so good because it's true. And I would say, you know, games like Fortnite have done a good job at trying to level the playing field, right? Like somebody hiding behind a bush in Fortnite could conceivably win a battle royale game. And, you know, I think Nintendo discovered their love for battle royale, obviously, as we've seen. But like that, it used to be true that if you didn't play Call of Duty day one, weeks later you'd come in and you'd be screwed, right? Like, and you were adding enjoyment to the winning player. I would say there's also enjoyment and loss in some ways, but I thought that was really insightful.
It's also, I believe, you know, sort of diametrically opposed to the philosophy that Yamauchi had beforehand. If you read a book like Game Over, which I was a big fan of sort of like growing up playing video games, that dude was not a gamer. He actually, like, they brought him video games and he would do bad at them and be like, don't ever bring this in here again. Like, Iwata was like, I'm first and foremost, I'm a gamer. Like, that's where I start. And then everything that's come out from that I've been able to center around the fact that at the end of the day, I like playing video games. And, you know, Hiroshi Yamauchi was basically just like, I want to make money. I want to, like, let's make a big business. And that was immensely important for Nintendo at the time. But, like, I don't think I think we realize it now. But in the moment to moment during the Iwata era of having the sort of Iwata Asks column going up every now and then in such a sort of historically closed company, you know, to get that level of transparency into anecdotal game design and stories and behind the scenes stuff, what worked, what didn't work, what they tried, what they didn't try, you know, what failed, like that was so magical to actually get that as a Nintendo fan, to get these columns that would pop up and people would translate them. I feel so lucky that we got that. I wish we got more of that. I'm a huge fan of like sort of the DVD extras, behind the scenes making of stuff with movies. Video games are so historically closed off that we never get that level of transparency until years after a studio is closed. Maybe a figurehead will come out and be like, this is what we tried, this is what we didn't try. This is the pushback we got. Like, I feel like we were so lucky to have that, to have him specifically be that open for a company that was so like traditionally closed off.
Yeah, it's been almost 6 years since Iwata's passing, and I think his absence is still very much felt in what we get from Nintendo now. I mean, even the Nintendo Directs have, I think, lost a lot of charm since we lost Iwata. I mean, you think about the Star Fox puppets and the Reggie and Iwata fighting each other at the Smash Brothers E3, and they introduced Amiibo. It's like, it's just such a cool moment.
There's nobody to hold up like a bunch of bananas anymore and like look directly, you know?
No, the personality was so important. I mean, look, obviously there's another side of Nintendo in that it is probably for young designers, very difficult to break through in the corporate culture. And like you sometimes hear stories. We just talked about the one from, you know, the creator of Monkey Ball and how it might be difficult to work with Nintendo because its lead designers are so strong-willed. And you get a little bit off that. You kind of hear Iwata's perception of Miyamoto, but there's no doubt that Iwata just brought this positivity and did a lot of things with his smile. And he was kind of a conundrum, right? Like he was somebody who was very casual in his thinking, but he was a programmer and he was able to lead this business to great success. He was able to, and Yamauchi appears in the book in one of the anecdotes that Yamauchi was so behind the Nintendo DS, he kept on bringing up the dual screen thing, right? Like, and I feel like Iwata was able to take on all these ideas and like bring them to fruition. But at the same time, he wanted a strict dress code and he always appeared in his suit, right? Like there are all these weird dichotomies. It's a really cool book. It's a really cool collection of things that you can read online if you speak Japanese, but it's really cool to have it collected in here. Mm-hmm.
So we have very little time, and very quickly, Logan, you've been playing Monster Hunter Rise. You are a fan. In 1 minute or less, what do you think?
I love it. About 60 hours in, and I think it feels amazing. The gameplay is great. The wire bug is outstanding. I really appreciate how it's easier to get new weapon types because I've been experimenting a lot more with different types of weapons I didn't play with in World, like the bow or the hunting horn, things like that I'm trying out that are new. The new monsters are amazing. Gossharog, the big Yeti beast, is like my new favorite monster ever. Such a Monster Hunter name. But yeah, I'm a really big fan of it, and I'm ready for the new title update because I think the end game is a little bit lacking. I think it's my biggest negative point. It doesn't feel quite done at the end stages, but I know they're going to support it for like the next 2 years probably, so I'm not worried about it.
I feel like basically exactly the same. Thanks.
Nice.
And I wish we could talk more about Ask Iwata and all of the other things. And we, just as a reminder, we did answer some of your question block questions at the top of the show. But with that, unfortunately, there is about all of the time we have left. Expect next week on Nintendo Voice Chat to be talking about new Pokemon Snap with the reviewer. I think I'll have Miranda on as well. It'll be a good time. Maybe we'll have one of you guys, if you would like to volunteer and rate some of the reviewers' photos. I think that
I would love to do that. That sounds like so much fun. You can print them now too, which is amazing. There's a brand new
technology. Hold them up.
Yeah. I can't wait to access this brand new technology and finally be able to get my photos off my phone, which you've never been able to do before. And we'll discuss that in detail next week on Nintendo Voice Chat, which comes out every Thursday at 3 p.m. Pacific time on your favorite podcasting platform. We hope to see you wherever you like to get your podcasts. And remember, Nintendo Voice Chat is the only place you can
get the thing.
Get the thing.
And play There Is No Game. It's great.
Hello, dear stranger. I'd like to introduce you to something new, or perhaps something very, very old. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine is a horror fantasy medical mystery following the titular monk turned traveling medical investigator. Follow Radolf as he navigates a nightmare world in which viruses are gods and the human race are not their favored children. Steeped in history and an aesthetic that can only be described as a combination of occult academia and laboratory Judaica, the Heresies of Radolf Burntwine have been described as Umberto Eco meets H.P. Lovecraft. For more information, check out the Patreon at thorb.info. But take care, dear stranger, for some truths are best left unknown.